Good day. Today is Monday, 9th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched or listened to this programme or whichever part of the programme you want to watch and listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, I'm going to say that today we're starting today in a mood of gathering crisis, not just in the United States and in the Middle East and in Israel, but across the world, with information that the international oil price is touching $120 a barrel. Obviously, the proximate cause for this steep increase in oil prices, almost a doubling of oil prices, is the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the fact that oil supply from the Persian Gulf has almost completely stopped. I suspect that the fact that there are now attacks taking place against oil infrastructure in the Middle East. I discussed in my program yesterday how the Israelis had launched attacks on Iranian oil refineries and oil installations. And this morning, there were reports that the Iranians were taking counter action, that they were launching attacks against oil installations in Bahrain and in the UAE and in all sorts of other places. Well, all of this is going to increase nervousness and worry within the global oil markets, within the maritime shipping and, importantly, maritime insurance industry. And we can increasingly see that oil flows are now almost oil flows from the Persian Gulf are almost at a standstill, and predictably, the oil price is surging. Now, in a program that I did, I think it might even be in my previous one, I mentioned something which I believe very strongly, based on my experience of financial and economic panics. If the oil price reaches $120 a barrel and stays there, and if it starts to go beyond it, then it will go higher, much higher, much higher still. It may not remain at whatever elevated extreme price it eventually reaches. I've seen many suggestions saying that it could hit $150 a barrel. I've seen one fairly well-known agency or research institution talking about $210 a barrel. It might not stay at those levels for very long. It could be that as the global economy moves into deep recession, and we see demand fall, it could be that that will cause the oil price to fall in turn, or it could be that the market will come to the conclusion that the oil price has overshot and there might be a correction and we could see oil prices fall back again. But the key thing to understand is that if we are really looking at $150 a barrel oil for any length of time, even if we're only talking about a few weeks, well, that is going to cause significant economic disruption. And if we are talking about $210 a barrel, well, the disruption is going to be much greater. And here again, I would add a further thing that I've noticed about financial panics, which is that as we see the oil price rise, the problems in the global economy, in the financial markets, tend to compound. So it is not a linear progression. It is more like a geometric one. The higher the price, the greater the disruption by orders of magnitude, until, of course, the disruption becomes so great that we start to see not just recession situations, but potentially something worse still, with cascading effects in financial markets, perhaps affecting financial institutions and that sort of thing. I don't want to discuss this in further detail. I'm not going to pretend that I'm an expert in these matters. I am not, but it is based on experience. I don't want to look forward to these outcomes. But there it is. That in my experience is what tends to happen. And at some level, policymakers in the West, in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, all understand this. So this morning, even as the oil price is rising, I was reading in the Financial Times, in fact, it's the lead article in the Financial Times, that the G7 states, that's the United States and its friends, are now in urgent discussions with each other about drawing on their accumulated reserves in order to try to take some steps to try to smooth over or stabilize oil prices. And this article talks grandly about the size of these reserves. It says that they are in the region of 1.1 billion barrels of oil. And it says that China has at least equivalent levels of reserves as well. And presumably all this talk about the G7 flooding the world with oil from its reserves is supposed to calm things and to steady the mood in the oil markets, and of course, possibly, conceivably, for a short time, it might do that. But there are a number of points to make here which need to be taken into account, and which I noticed that this article in the Financial Times really didn't address, which is that by far the biggest strategic oil reserve amongst the G7 is the one that is held by the United States, except that oil reserve is heavily depleted. Joe Biden's administration drew heavily on the reserve during the 2022-2023 oil crisis in order to smooth the effect of oil prices in the United States. It was well aware of the bad political repercussions for Biden and the Democrats of a very high oil price. And so they drew down very heavily on the US's strategic reserve. President Trump, when he became president, said that he would reverse this, that he would build up America's strategic reserve. However, he failed to do so, and I understand that whilst the American reserve, oil reserve, the safety margin is supposed to be around 500 million barrels of oil. In fact, it is much closer to 400 million barrels of oil. In other words, it is far below the level, the usual margin of safety. So that then brings us to what might happen, because for Donald Trump, for the Republicans, for the administration, trying to smooth or contain energy price increases in the United States is a political imperative. And it may be, in fact, I am certain that it will be, that any oil that the Trump administration releases will be mostly intended to contain oil price increases in the United States itself, and they might be skewed to achieve that, possibly by holding back oil for the domestic American market. And if the United States starts to do that, expect all the other countries, all the other members of the G7 very quickly to start doing the same thing, against perhaps a background of growing argument and recriminations. We could see Japan, South Korea, the Europeans, all clinging on to their oil reserves because they see an open-ended crisis in terms of the situation in the Middle East and the Straits of Hormuz, and they sense that the Americans are not sharing their oil. That is speculative on my part. It might be that the Americans behave with uncharacteristic generosity, and of course it's always possible that the Straits of Hormuz might reopen, in which case in perhaps a month or two, things in the oil markets might just conceivably return to something closer to normal. But if things continue the way they are, then long before we start seeing oil reserves significantly depleted in the West, we will see all of this momentum start to happen. We will see a fragmentation in the oil reserve situation, the way in which G7 governments respond. They will all of them try to cling on to their oil. They will try to husband their oil in order, especially if they sense that this thing is going to continue for a long time, in order to cover a situation where the situation might not be resolved quickly. And of course, they will need to hold back some oil to keep at least a basic economy running. This move by the G7 is unsurprising, but it doesn't even begin to solve the problem. I doubt actually that it even addresses it. And there was something else, incidentally, that the Financial Times entirely failed to say. Yes, there are reserves of oil. China has enormous reserves of oil, at least similar to those of the G7. But those, of course, are intended for China's use, and they're not going to be shared. But there are reserves of oil in the G7 and in other places around the world as well. But the same is not true with natural gas. Natural gas reserves in Europe are around 30% of necessary levels. Natural gas usage in Europe over the winter was very heavy, and the reserves were significantly run down. Supplies of natural gas from Russia have, of course, stopped. Ukraine and Hungary and Slovakia are involved in a major quarrel over the Druzhba pipeline. Ukraine refuses to allow natural gas from Russia to flow through the Druzhba pipeline to Hungary and Slovakia. Hungary and Slovakia are retaliating by imposing sanctions on Ukraine of their own. They're going to stop exports of energy, of diesel oil, perhaps electricity as well. So there is that issue. Vladimir Putin has recently said that Russia needs to stop and stop immediately supplies of liquefied natural gas to Europe. He said in an interview that he gave to his favorite journalist, Pavel Zarubin, that there is no point in Russia continuing to supply LNG to Europe, given that the Europeans have already made a decision that from 2027, they're no longer going to accept, they're no longer going to source LNG from Russia. So LNG from Russia, according to Putin, should transfer to Asian markets. Now, Putin did not give an order for this to happen. He said that there should be a study by the government and by the natural gas industry considering on whether to consider whether or not something like that should be done. In practice and in reality, if Putin publicly says something like this, you can be certain that that study has already been made, that it has already reported its preliminary views to the Kremlin, and that the Russians have all but made that decision to transfer their natural gas flows eastwards, mostly, I am guessing, to China. So, no natural gas flowing from Qatar, the world's third largest producer of natural gas, limited supplies of natural gas from other producers, Norway, Algeria, Azerbaijan, but there might be problems with flows of natural gas from Azerbaijan because it too looks as if it might become drawn into this wider crisis in the Middle East. And besides, its natural gas flows across pipelines, through pipelines, mostly controlled by Russia, just saying. So, uncertainties about supplies of natural gas to Europe, inability to source it from Qatar, and of course an energy crisis starting to develop in the United States. And I have repeatedly warned, I have warned since long before this crisis in the Middle East began, that it always seemed to me that there was a possibility in a crisis that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, or conceivably even a successor to Donald Trump, might decide that prioritizing the domestic energy market in the United States, trying to keep a cap on energy costs in the United States, dictated a stopping of LNG exports. And I can very easily see, I can very easily imagine how in this situation where natural gas prices are also rising in the United States against a backdrop of rising oil prices and energy prices altogether, that at some point within the next few weeks or months, Donald Trump and the administration might decide to do this very thing. It's often overlooked that the United States only became a significant LNG exporter very recently. From my recollection, and I might be wrong here, but I believe that until relatively recently, there were actually laws in the United States restricting LNG exports precisely in order to keep the cost of natural gas in the United States itself stable. So There might be reserves of oil lying around which can be tapped at this time. I've already discussed the problems with that, but reserves of natural gas are an entirely different matter. Even as the oil price touched $120 a barrel shortly before I started making this program, I saw that the natural gas price in Europe now stands at $800 per million cubic centimeters. I believe that's the correct measure. And that's the highest gas price since January 2023. And there is every reason to expect that it will go much, much further. And if it goes higher still, if the Americans start to restrict exports, well, in Europe, the sky is the limit. I saw Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's direct investment fund, make a comment that in Germany, industry is in free fall. He might have been exaggerating, but if all of these outcomes start to happen, then frankly, what he is perhaps saying now could become an accurate prediction of what may come. Now, what is extraordinary about all of this is that it was perfectly predictable. The outcomes that I've just been describing, $150 a barrel oil, $210 a barrel oil, if it comes to that, I mean, they would have been well within the range of what people might expect if they had considered seriously the possibility of Iran closing the Straits of Hormuz and keeping the Straits of Hormuz closed for a extended period. And, well, as Mr. Pereira described in that Substack piece I discussed 2 or 3 days ago, it was also completely predictable that the insurance markets, the maritime insurance markets, would pull insurance from ships, merchant ships, tankers operating close to a war zone, such as the Straits of Hormuz has now turned out to be. Again, had attempts been made to check out the position with the insurance markets and with the ship owners and with the oil company executives and, by the way, with the gas company executives, all of this could have been and should have been predicted. And I have to say again, all of the possibilities that I've just discussed about natural gas shortages across Europe, about closures of factories, accelerated deindustrialization, a major crisis in Europe, all of that was predictable as well. I've been reading in the media over the last couple of days that Britain has around 2 days of reserves of natural gas. Of course, Britain is in an extreme position. The British government has rushed to reassure everybody that there is no cause for concern and that the situation isn't as bad as that. I happen to know that it is every bit as bad as that. Just saying. So all of this is predictable. But nobody, apparently, amongst the people who took the decision to begin the war with Iran just over a week ago, appeared to have thought about it. There's no evidence that Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Marco Rubio took wide soundings, sought wide information across the energy and industrial and insurance and maritime industry sectors about what a war in the Persian Gulf might mean. And I have to say, this reminds me exactly of what happened in February 2022 when the Biden administration began its sanctions war, its economic war against Russia. There was no, as I happen to know, no wide consultation as to the actual effect of sanctions on the Russian economy, whether the predicted collapse of the Russian economy would in fact happen. I've consulted all sorts of people, many people whom I know, who've had involvement in the Russian economy, who know much about the industrial base. In these programs, I've consulted with an engineer, a British engineer, who has actually visited factories all over Russia. I asked him, did anybody seek your advice? He said no. And that's what I've heard from every other person I have spoken to. When the disastrous decision to freeze the Russian central bank's reserves was made, it turns out that neither the Federal Reserve Board, nor the European Central Bank, nor the Bank of England were consulted in advance. There was no wide discussion of this idea, no discussion of what the implications of it might be for the international financial markets and for the reserve currency status of the various Western currencies, nor was there any real discussion about what the disconnection of Russian banks from the SWIFT interbank payment system might actually do. There was a blithe assumption that the entire banking system in Russia would freeze up and implode. No one seemed to understand that the Russians had already created their own alternative messaging service, specifically in anticipation of this very event. So one might have thought that that failure to assess risk, the risk of all of these actions, the possible consequences of taking astonishing extreme measures like sanctioning Russia in the way that was done, or attacking Iran in the way that was done, one might have expected that the Trump people would learn from the mistakes of the Biden people. But of course, nothing like that happened. And this is where we now are. And of course, you are now starting to see all of the early signs of panic. The president says that $100 a barrel of oil is no big deal. It is a small price to pay for the victory he's going to achieve in Iran. He's never quite explained what form he expects this victory to take. He's grandly talked about regime change, about being the person who selects the supreme leader and all of those things. But if you're actually looking for a post-war strategy, a strategy even after victory, a plan, well, he's never outlined it, and he's never come up and neither is his administration, with any clear set of objectives. So that's the president. Senator Lindsey Graham has spoken grandly about the United States taking control of Iran's oil industry, just as the United States has taken control, or virtual control, of Venezuela's oil industry, again, apparently based on all kinds of assumptions about how easy it would be to get that deeply corroded oil industry back online and back online quickly. So Senator Graham appears to believe that the United States can and will achieve the same thing with Iran. And of course, as I discussed in my program yesterday, we are already hearing stories about the United States seizing Harg Island, the major center of the Iranian oil export industry, the port and facility through which Iran's oil exports are channeled. Well, again, before Senator Graham achieves that result, the United States has to win the war against Iran. For the moment, it doesn't appear to be doing so. We'll come to all of that shortly. And even if it does win the war, what the state of the oil industry will then be, what the state of Iran will then be, whether Iran is in any position to export oil. It took years after the fall of Saddam Hussein before the Iraqi oil industry properly came back online. Anyway, we can leave, I suppose, Senator Graham to his dreams. And, at the same time, we hear that the United States is extremely alarmed, or was extremely alarmed yesterday, by the Israeli attacks on Iran's oil refineries, on Iran's oil industry. This is, by the way, absurd. I cannot imagine that the Israelis and the Americans, in conducting their offensive, their air and missile offensive against Iran, are not in constant liaison with each other, and that the Israelis are not informing the Americans of what installations they are attacking. If the Israelis attacked oil refineries in Iran and oil facilities in Iran, they would surely have done this with the full knowledge of relevant US officials who were almost certainly participating in the planning. Just saying. But now we're told that the United States is very alarmed about this. Well, obviously they are, with oil now rising to $120 a barrel. So the Americans are very unhappy about this. Senator Graham has written another message saying that the Israelis need to stop doing this, that they need to understand and remember that Iran will need all of these oil facilities, all of these production facilities in the future in order to achieve a prosperous life once the hated regime of the Ayatollahs has been overthrown. This is, by the way, the same Senator Graham who has just a few hours before talked grandly about the United States gaining control of Iran's oil. Just saying. He's now suddenly discovered a concern for the welfare of Iran's people, and he wants Iran's oil industry preserved for that reason. In fact, the real reason why the Americans panicked over those Israeli attacks was because the Iranians then started to make announcements that following the attack on their oil facilities, they are going to start conducting attacks of their own on oil facilities in the various Gulf states around the Persian Gulf. And there are reports that the Iranians have already conducted powerful attacks against oil facilities in Bahrain, and that these facilities have been so badly damaged or destroyed that they are inoperable and will remain so for many, many months, even if the fighting ends. So suddenly there is this panic where we've got to stop this. This is an incredibly bad idea. I said in one of my recent videos that attacks on Iranian desalination plants and attacks on Iranian oil facilities seem to me extremely unwise, even if you accept the logic of this military operation, which of course I don't, because those attacks invited counterattacks on desalination plants in Israel and the Arab states and on oil facilities across the Gulf, and by the way, in Israel itself, which would inevitably have very, very negative consequences. I in fact pointed out that in terms of Iran's oil industry, because of the size of Iran, the huge scale upon which Iran operates, Iran probably has more ability to absorb blows like this and can also probably receive oil, and including refined oil products from Russia especially, which will enable Iran to keep going. Whereas Israel and the Gulf states are not in the same position. But nonetheless, despite all of that, those attacks on the desalination plants, the Iranian desalination plants, and the oil refineries took place. And as I said, the Iranians threatened and, by the way, carried out acts of retaliation. And we see the administration and Senator Graham panic. And over the next few hours, we heard that the discredited duo of Kushner and Witkoff were flying to Israel to tell the Israelis, don't do this again. Except a short time ago, we heard that this very same trip by the discredited duo of Witkoff and Kushner to Israel to give this warning to the Israelis, that trip has been called off, it's been cancelled. I wonder why. I wonder whether it's because the Israelis, who are also themselves, I should say now, in what I will describe it as an exalted mood. If you read and listen to some Israeli commentaries, one senses decision makers there who are also becoming increasingly detached from reality. Well, it could be that the Israelis were not happy with this message, that they're not prepared to acknowledge these realities. Or it could be that the Israelis did the opposite. They told Kushner and Witkoff, oh, you don't need to come because we've already taken the message, we've accepted the message, and we are not going to attack Iranian desalination plants and oil facilities after all. Or, and this is also a further possibility which should not be overlooked, it could be that with the present chaos in the Middle East, with the missiles falling across the Middle East and on Israel itself, with Hezbollah in Lebanon now also joining in and conducting its own missile and rocket strikes on Israel, with the Houthis threatening to do so, it could be that Witkoff and Kushner have looked at the situation and have decided that maybe going traveling to Israel at this time might not be such a good idea. After all, it might in fact be rather dangerous. Just saying. Well, I'm not going to explore this. Again, once more, actions taken without any planning, without any regard for the consequences. And one can be massively critical of this administration, which I am, by the way. I want to make that very clear. But it's starting to look like a pattern, because as I discussed a moment ago, the previous administration, Joe Biden's administration, with regard to Russia, was the same. And of course, we've had all of these airy comments from President Trump about, and other officials, Pete Hegseth, about how there is actually no shortage of advanced weapons. The United States has abundant supplies of advanced weapons. The United States can keep up this war indefinitely. That's what has been said by the president and by some of his officials. And, well, again, lots of people, not just me, pointed out that this was absolutely not the case. There were articles in the American media itself saying that there would be problems in an attack on Iran because missile numbers were running low. Eli Lake and Jennifer Kavanaugh have already written articles, already wrote articles before the war began about the shortages of air defense missiles. And now we read that in fact the shortages have become so bad that the Europeans, still obsessed with keeping Vladimir Zelensky armed to the level that President Zelensky has come to expect. Anyway, the Europeans are now becoming increasingly alarmed because they still place orders with the United States for more and more weapons for President Zelensky, but they can't deliver them because they have to send them again instead to the Middle East. And in fact, as a number of people have now been pointing out, we are now in the absurd situation that instead of Ukraine receiving assistance from the West, the United States is now looking for assistance from Ukraine to deal with the drone attacks. Now, here I'm going to suggest the Iranian drone attacks. Now, here I'm going to suggest that the Americans might as well spare themselves the trouble. Yes, the Ukrainians will send some people who do obviously have significant knowledge of how to deal with Russian drones. But it ought to be obvious by now, with what has been happening in the Middle East, that all of the various grandiose claims we have been hearing from the Ukrainians about their enormous success in shooting down Russian missiles and in shooting down Russian drones has been massively inflated. Professor Postol has repeatedly cast doubt on claims about Ukrainian or Western ability to shoot down ballistic missiles. In fact, he has repeatedly said that shooting down ballistic missiles is impossible. It can happen every so often, but it is, in that case, merely a lucky hit. The actual ability to do that does not exist. I ought to say here that I am not entirely sure that Professor Postol is totally right about this. I think that the Russians, specifically the Russians, do have a certain ability to shoot down ballistic missiles. They appear to have had some success, for example, with certain types of Ukrainian ballistic missiles and also HIMARS rockets. At least that's what they say. It may be that the Russians are overstating their success too. But bear in mind that the air defense systems that Israel and the United States have been using, mostly Patriots, but also TADS, and also Israel's various own air defense systems, the Iron Dome, David Sling, all of those, they are either the same as the ones that the Ukrainians have been using, the Patriots, or they're actually more sophisticated, as the TADS and the Iron Dome and David Sling systems presumably are. And yet, they are having limited success, perhaps even no success, in shooting down the more advanced Iranian ballistic missiles. So, given that that is so, why do people take seriously the continued Ukrainian claims that they have been successful in shooting down hypersonic Russian missiles like the Kinjal, the Tsarkon, and ballistic missiles like the Iskander? I've never myself taken these claims from Ukraine seriously, but of course many, many people in the West have. Well, they now see from the performance of the same Western systems in the Middle East how fantastical, how unreal those Ukrainian claims actually were. And given that that is the case, given that Ukrainian ability claims about shooting down ballistic missiles are almost certainly, I would argue, provably shown to have been untrue, why assume that the Ukrainians really do have the prowess in shooting down drones that they claim? Certainly they can shoot down some, but can they really shoot down as many as they say? And yes, the Ukrainians have developed anti-drone drones, they use them, but this has been in the relatively structured battles, air battles, that have taken place in Ukraine over a vastly wider territory, such as we see in the Middle East. That might not be true. And besides, I'd already seen reports in Ukraine that the effectiveness of these anti-drone drones that Ukraine has been greatly exaggerated. Anyway, there it is. We are in an extraordinary situation. There seems to have been no preparation, no idea of how to plan or win this war. To be frank, I can't really see very much planning at all. And I read an article in, admittedly, The Intercept, which I don't consider to be a fully reliable publication in these matters. Its hostility to Donald Trump is so strong that they will never hesitate to make even the worst situation involving Trump, even worse than it actually is, just to say. But anyway, they are saying that they have been speaking to all sorts of people within the administration, within the United States government, trying to understand, trying to find out from them what the plan for the war is, and that all of these people come back and say that they can discern no plan at all, that it is all being made up from day to day, that all sorts of plans are floated and then dropped. We had the idea of using the Kurds. We've had ideas about capturing Kharga Island. We have more aircraft carriers being sent to join the two existing aircraft carriers. But it's all been made up as the thing continues. Now, the Iranians, as I've discussed in many programs, clearly do have, by contrast, a battle strategy, which is to wear the Americans and the Israelis down, and also to allow events in the oil markets eventually to take their course. Again, the Iranians are not announcing any demands or objectives. All that they say is that they want a permanent peace. They want a guarantee at the end of this battle that there will be no renewed battle, no renewed attack on their country in the future. They have not explained what structures, what safeguards they would require, what guarantees they would require from the Americans and the Israelis to ensure that, and to ensure that those guarantees, once they are given, are cast iron and will be indefinitely enforced. Just saying. But for the moment, I get the sense that the Iranians are adopting a diplomatic tactic, which I remember that the Soviet Union used to use quite a lot, which is to say very little, to say nothing, to keep the other side guessing all the time about what it would settle for, to let events take their course, to let the stress on the other side increase, the heat increase, and to wait for the other side as it becomes more desperate, more anxious to end the war, to come up with proposals which can then either be accepted when they reach the necessary level or can be rejected in the interim. I remember one of the American diplomats who used to negotiate strategic arms control limits with the Soviets described it as putting money in a defective slot machine. You put in more and more money, nothing necessarily comes out, but you have no choice but to go on putting in more and more until eventually something comes back. Well, that could be the Iranian strategy. As I said, I've seen it done. The Russians certainly did it during the Cold War. I get the sense that the Chinese do it too. From an Iranian point of view, it clearly does make a kind of sense. Meanwhile, the Iranians have now announced the identity of their new supreme leader. And he is, in fact, the son of the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, I understand that the new supreme leader, who is, I believe, 57, is not yet an Ayatollah. Some people seem to think that this is a major issue. This is an Iranian matter. For the record, Khamenei, the previous supreme leader, the father of the new Khamenei, who is now supreme leader, was also not yet an Ayatollah when he became Iran's supreme leader of 30 years ago. And eventually, Khamenei did become an Ayatollah, and he eventually acquired the status of a Marja, one of that small group of Iranian, of Shia clerical officials who are able to issue, to make, to give guidance on questions of Islamic law and Islamic conduct that are considered authoritative by the Shia community as a whole. Whether the son will achieve that level of learning and status, well, only time can say. Now, I'm not going to discuss in detail this Iranian decision to make the junior Khamenei the successor to the father. I know very little about this younger man. He said he's been described by somebody who had dealings with him, a Western commentator who had dealings with him, as a forceful personality and as an extremely effective administrator, which suggests that he's a rather, shall we say, less unworldly figure in some respects, a more hands-on figure than his father was. I've also seen suggestions that he has been heavily involved as his father's son and as one of his father's key advisors in the political, military and economic structures in Iran, that he is, in other words, an insider who knows how the system works and where all the levers are and who is really important in the system and who is not. I suspect that at this moment of crisis, these were more important factors than Islamic scholarship. Just to say. And, well, allegedly, according to some reports, he was a conservative and a hardliner. And as has been pointed out, also by many reports, many members of his family, his immediate family, his father, apparently a sibling, perhaps his wife, one of his children, were all killed on the first day of this conflict because they were all there in Khamenei's residence when the Israeli missiles struck. And, well, putting aside whether this individual was previously a hardliner or not, he would not be human if he didn't feel extraordinary loathing and antipathy towards the Americans and the Israelis after the loss of so many members of his family, and if this did not influence his decisions. Now, one world leader, President Putin of Russia, has congratulated the new Khamenei on succeeding to the position of Iran's supreme leader. I understand that in Iran, the supreme leader, as well as being the commander-in-chief of the Iranian armed forces, all of which, by the way, have pledged their loyalty to him. Anyway, I understand that Khamenei, the new Khamenei, is now Iran's head of state. So for that reason, the congratulatory letter from Putin is perhaps understandable, but again, it re-emphasizes the further fact that the Russians have been quite openly taking Iran's side in this conflict. In fact, the Russian ambassador to Britain said quite straightforwardly that Russia is not neutral in this conflict. Iran is an ally. Iran has been attacked. Russia is on Iran's side. Now, the Russians continue to be active in their diplomatic activities. Lavrov has had further discussions with the leaders of the Gulf states. He also hosted a meeting in Moscow which brought together the ambassadors of the Gulf states. He made no secret of his irritation that the Gulf states, in proposing a ceasefire resolution to the UN Security Council, appeared to be calling for a cessation of attacks upon themselves by Iran. Lavrov pointed out that this was unbalanced, that Iran had previously been attacked, that a resolution in order to fly needs balance, and that the proposed resolution that the Gulf states clearly was not balanced. And, well, the Russians are now floating a new proposal, a summit meeting of the permanent members of the Security Council, Trump, Putin, Xi Jinping, and by the way, Macron and Starmer. Very difficult meeting to imagine. But anyway, a meeting of the leaders, a summit meeting of the permanent members of the Security Council, in order to see what way forward can be charted in order to achieve what the Russians call a cessation of hostilities in the Middle East. In the meantime, as I discussed in my program yesterday, the Russians continue to gain benefits from the immediate crisis. With $120, oil at $120 a barrel, if this continues, if this situation continues for much longer, the Russians will not only be able to close all the gaps in their budget this year, but I suspect they're going to be able to rebuild their reserves, their financial reserves, and pay off or plug whatever remaining holes there were in the Russian budget last year. As I said previously, people are overstating the significance of the financial stress that Russia has been under. And that financial stress, anyway, has, in my opinion, been connected less to lower oil prices than to the very high interest rates that the Russian Central Bank imposed in order to bring inflation under control. that the Russians are going to accrue significant benefits from what is happening is indisputable. And there has now been, as the Russians themselves have confirmed, a flood of new orders for oil from India. And the Russians are indeed stepping up supplies of oil to India. However, whereas in the past Russian oil supplies to India came with a discount, this time they're coming at a premium. I still suspect that India is getting the oil from Russia at a lower price than it would from, say, the United States, but it is not as cheap as it used to be. Now, over the last couple of days, there have been many reports about how India sought a license from the United States to resume imports of Russian oil. I said that, to my knowledge, that was entirely wrong. India never sought a license to stop buying Russian oil. It was the United States that anticipated that India would be buying more Russian oil, which rushed out an announcement that it had given India permission to do this. And this has finally provoked a very strong message, a statement from the Indian Foreign Ministry. They have said that India does not require the US's permission to buy Russian oil. And they want to make that fact fully understood, that it is India itself and no other party that makes that decision. I think that the Indians are now almost at the limit of their patience with the Trump administration. They've had to stomach Trump making up telephone calls with Prime Minister Modi, in which Modi is supposed to have promised Trump that India would stop buying Russian oil. They've had to stomach tariffs from the United States, some of which are about India's general trade with the United States, but some of which have also been intended to put pressure on India to stop India buying Russian oil. They probably are genuinely annoyed about the sinking of the Iranian frigate that left India after attending a naval exercise there. Prime Minister Modi has been coming under increasing criticism, both from Iran and within India itself, because he has not publicly rebuked the Americans for doing this. There are reports coming out of India that the Indian authorities were providing the United States with information about the whereabouts of the Iranian frigate. I suspect that those reports are true, but I do not think, contrary to some speculations, that the Indians did that in order to facilitate the sinking of this frigate. On the contrary, I think the Indians were providing this information in order to ensure, or to try to ensure, that the Americans kept their distance from this frigate so that it was kept out of harm's way. That is my understanding of what happened. Anyway, as we know, the frigate was sunk. Large numbers of sailors died. Prime Minister Modi has been criticised. I think this extraordinary announcement from the United States that they'd granted India permission to buy Russian oil when, as the Indians are now for the first time straightforwardly saying, they never stopped, India never stopped buying Russian oil. It continued to buy Russian oil in January and February and has every intention of still doing so. Anyway, I think this was finally the moment when the Indians felt that they couldn't accept this any longer, and they came out publicly with the statement that India makes its own decisions. It is not for the United States to tell India what it should do. Anyway, there we go. So the Russians are making money. They are receiving all this money. They are positioning themselves in the future to try to see what they can achieve in order to achieve the cessation of hostilities in the Middle East and to change the security structure in the Gulf. But in the meantime, the war goes on. And for the moment, it goes on in the way that it always has. The United States continues to conduct, and Israel continue to conduct air and missile strikes on Iran. Iran continues to conduct drone and missile strikes on the Gulf states, on Israel, on American bases scattered across the Middle East. The Straits of Hormuz remain shut. The calculus has not changed. The situation overall in the war has not changed. There are reports, there's some claims, I should say, more than reports, that the situation in some of the Arab states is now becoming critical. Bahrain has now invoked force majeure. It is no longer able, or so it says, to export oil. As I've said in recent programs, as the oil storage depots across the Gulf fill up, one producer after another is soon going to have to declare force majeure and stop production. So, as I said, everything points to the situation deteriorating, and that deterioration, I suspect, is going to continue. And across the world, it will be registered by an ever-increasing energy price. With all of these effects this is going to have on the global economy. I should quickly add, by the way, that I read a report that the energy shock this time is potentially 17 times greater than the energy shock that followed the start of the conflict in Ukraine in February 2022. And it's entirely understandable why, because Russia was always able to maintain its energy exports. It was able to continue to export oil at similar volumes. Its gas exports fell, but not its oil exports. Whereas this time, that isn't the case, because Persian Gulf production has been taken, or is being taken, off stream. Well, there it is. No, as I said, no forethought, no planning, no real idea what to do. Clearly, expectations that Khamenei's death would lead to a collapse in Iran. no clear idea what to do after that collapse failed to happen. A war that continues because Israel and the United States are now trapped inside it. The Gulf states trapped inside it even further. And the Iranians calculating that it is not in their interests that it be brought to a stop now. In fact, they appear almost to be welcoming escalation against themselves. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, when asked about Iran's fears about an American ground invasion, basically said, bring it on. Well, there it is. This is where we are in this war. It looks as if it is metastasizing, as I said, into a long war. The Americans continue to say, to claim that Iran is running out of drone launchers and missile launchers and missiles and drones. But for the record, I haven't seen myself this great reduction in Iranian drone and missile strikes that some people are claiming to see. Whereas shortages of equipment in the United States and Israel are indeed increasingly becoming visible. Entering a war without a plan seems to me extraordinary. And clearly, no one in the administration sat down and thought it through, even though that still strikes me as extraordinary. Anyway, there it is. Let me now finish off this programme by returning to the topic of the situation in Ukraine. There is now growing alarm in Europe that, and even amongst some commentators, that Jennifer Kavanaugh has a piece about this, that with Russia now benefiting from the elevated energy prices and with Ukraine receiving less and less in military support and equipment, ultimately from the United States, the Russians are now in a crushing advantage, and that their interest in negotiations has evaporated. There are some further clues that this is indeed the case. President Putin has given another interview in which he has spoken about the massive disruption to the global system carried out by the reckless and lawless behaviour of the Western powers. His press spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has again defended Russia's practice of conducting negotiations with the Ukrainians and the Americans, as saying that it had been in Russia's interests to do that. But he is clearly on the defensive. He tried to say that the difference between the negotiations with the Americans, the negotiations the Russians have conducted with the Americans, and the negotiations the Iranians have conducted with the Americans, is that the Russians had direct discussions with the Americans, whereas the Iranians were talking to the Americans through an intermediary, who was the foreign minister of Oman. And supposedly, this makes all the difference. I myself can't see that it makes any difference at all. All it means is that the Americans, instead of lying to the Iranians indirectly by giving false messages through the Omani foreign minister, have been lying to the Americans directly, just to say, to the Russians directly in face-to-face meetings. I don't really see why, as I said, using an intermediary to pass the lies, to transmit the lies, makes any significant difference. But apparently Zelensky himself has told the Americans that the negotiations with the Russians need to be called off. And by the way, we might have had a reason for this, because Admiral Kostyakov, the leader, the head of Russia's military intelligence, the leader of the negotiating team, the Russian negotiating team, which met with the Ukrainians twice in Abu Dhabi, and who is also a member of the negotiating team that participated in the last failed meeting in Geneva, when the Russian delegation was headed by Putin's aide, Vladimir Medinsky. Anyway, Kostyakov has now given an interview in which he's confirmed that the Russians did indeed bring up the whole subject of the dirty war in the various meetings, and that they particularly pressed the Ukrainians over the course of the Abu Dhabi meetings and perhaps the meeting in Geneva. I presume mostly the meeting in Geneva, in the Geneva meeting, that they pressed the Ukrainians particularly toughly and hard on the attempted assassination of Kostyakov's deputy in Russian military intelligence, Lieutenant General Alexeyev. Just saying. I said that part of the original purpose of the Abu Dhabi meetings was for the Russians to discuss the dirty war with the Ukrainians, and Kostyakov, or so it seems to me, has basically confirmed that. Anyway, there are no meetings at the moment. The Russians are going to be flush with cash very soon. They probably already are. They're probably getting payments sent to them already from their various customers for oil and gas. Though I would say that for the moment, there's been no big surge in the value of the ruble. It's still at 78 rubles a dollar, which is, I suspect, where the Russian Central Bank wants it to stay. Anyway, the Russians flush with cash, knowing that the Ukrainians are short of men and machines, and are unlikely to receive more machines from the West. Anyway, the Russians continue their various advances. They continue their advances around Slavyansk and Zaporozhye and Dobropilye as well. And we've had more information about the latest big Russian strike on Ukrainian energy facilities. And it does indeed appear to have done very, very considerable damage. However, the key thing to say is that the main Russian offensive is going to take place in April, after the end of the spring thaw, which is now upon us. The thaw which turns the landscape, the Ukrainian landscape, into mud. The Ukrainians are trying to comfort themselves by saying that after this summer offensive, the Russians will have exhausted their capabilities and will not be able to maintain further offensive operations in Ukraine. That is complete nonsense, just saying. The Russians have ample reserves of trained manpower. They have, as all sorts of commentators have pointed out, large reserve armies that have so far not been committed to the battle. So any idea circulating in Ukraine that after this year the Russians are going to run out of steam is fantastical. Of course, the Ukrainians have made identical claims many times. I remember in particular in March 2022, shortly after the special military operation, reading all sorts of reports about how the Russians had run out of missiles and how they didn't have engines for their subsonic missiles and how their entire tank fleet had been catastrophically depleted and that it would take at least a decade to replace it and all of those things. It is a sign of growing desperation in Ukraine that they are coming up with these fantastic claims now. So the big moment in Ukraine is going to come in April. There will be the Russian offensive starting then. And with the Western economies in crisis, with every likelihood of an ongoing conflict in the Middle East, which has every possibility of turning, of reaching a catastrophic turn, one has to say that the prospects for Ukraine do not look at all good. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. Don't forget that you can check out, don't forget that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.